Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Let's try that. Yeah. Well done, David.
Thank you.
Invoices in the mail.
Milton Osborne makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute.
Please.
You've been here about twice before, or is it three times? Twice. This is the third time. On the occasion of the publication of the Phnom Penh, A Cultural and Literary History. And I'll introduce Milton very briefly. He first lived in Phnom Penh in 1959 to 1961 and has continued to return regularly to the city. Dr. Osborne is the author of 9 books on the history and politics of Southeast Asia. He's an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Asian Studies at the Australian National University in Canberra and a visiting fellow at the Lowy Institute for International Policy in Sydney, and we have rival titles. The Sydney Institute title is Phnom Penh Yesterday and Today, and Milton Osborne's title is Writing a Book About Phnom Penh. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard. People can hear me at the back. I've got a loud voice anytime. It's very kind of the Sydney Institute and through Gerard to the host for me to talk about my new book, which was released in Australia last month. 3 years ago, or nearly 3 years ago, I was asked by an English publisher to write a book about Phnom Penh, Cambodia's capital, a city where I first went to live nearly 50 years ago, in 1959, when I was a junior Australian diplomat. It's a city I've continued to return to ever since. Indeed, I just returned 3 weeks ago from my last visit. There are probably as many ways to write about a city as there are cities, and this is surely so when writing about Phnom Penh. In ways apparent even to a first-time visitor, it has its own special character, notably different, for example, from the great cities of Europe. It has nothing to match their millennial histories and their variety of museums. Nor shifting geographical perspective to Asia, does Phnom Penh possess the literary tradition of a Calcutta or the imperial history of Beijing. In so many ways, and by comparison with so many cities, Phnom Penh is different. Newer in terms of its significance as a capital, never a centre for the production of great art, and with an indigenous literary tradition which, while rich in itself, is barely accessible to outsiders. But to think that this robs Phnom Penh of interest is to be badly mistaken. Phnom Penh has only attained its fixed status as a capital city relatively recently. This is true despite the fact that it was Cambodia's capital for about 30 years in the 15th century, and for short periods in succeeding centuries. It was, remarkably enough, briefly the site of imperial derring-do in the 16th century and 17th century, when Iberian adventurers played a brief role in Cambodian affairs. And at the same time, Catholic missionaries from Portugal and Spain, who were singularly unsuccessful in their efforts to convert the Cambodian population, the Buddhist population of Cambodia, were active in the city. But its life as a city of consequence really did not begin till 1866, when Cambodia's French protectors persuaded the Cambodian king to move his capital to Phnom Penh from Udong, a site some 40 kilometres to the north of the present city. And so in its modern form, Phnom Penh is a little younger than Singapore and a little older than Kuala Lumpur. But it's much younger as a major Southeast Asian centre than Jakarta, which was known as Batavia when the Dutch imposed their rule there in the 17th century. Now, with one notable exception, a visitor to Phnom Penh will not be rewarded by finding a store of great art. But that exception is the superb collection of pre-Angkorian, that's before 802 AD or Common Era, and Angkorian period for between 802 and 1431. And this is the statuary that you will find in the National Museum. None of these wonderful items were produced in Phnom Penh, and the Royal Palace is a relatively recent construction and much smaller in size and interest than the better-known Grand Palace in Bangkok. Throughout Phnom Penh, there are some interesting examples of architecture dating from the colonial years, and they remind you that Phnom Penh, Cambodia, was once part of France's colonial empire. And there are also architecturally interesting buildings from the independent years. But like those from the colonial period, they are limited in number and increasingly being overshadowed by more modern construction. Indeed, in the economic boom time that has developed over the past 10 years, the size of the city has expanded dramatically, and for the first time, high-rise buildings are being constructed. The first one that's being built right now is going to have 42 stories, and the fact of this and others will transform the low-rise city that I have known for so many years. What really makes Phnom Penh a city of interest is the extraordinary human aspect of its short modern history. For although the city's name is forever linked in the mind of outsiders with the horrors of the Pol Pot regime in the 1970s, there is much more to Phnom Penh's history from the middle of the 19th century than those blood-soaked years when rationality appeared to have vanished forever from Cambodia. Beyond the little-known Iberian interlude in the late 16th century that I referred to, the history that grips the imagination involves the personalities and passions of the men and women whose lives determined the city's evolution. This is the story that encompasses the bitter battle between Norodom I, the first king to reign under French protection, and the colonial officials who sought to diminish his power. The determination and apparent success of those same officials to transform a deeply traditional society, the role of Norodom Sihanouk, Norodom I's flamboyant great-grandson, in his various guises as king, prime minister, chief of state, and ally of the Khmer Rouge, the Red Khmer or Red Cambodians, which was a term Sihanouk himself originally coined to describe his communist opponents in the 1960s. It's a story that encompassed the horrific bloodshed during the Pol Pot period, and now finally, it's a story that encompasses the emergence of a city under an authoritarian leader, which is as sharply divided between rich and poor as any in the developing world. Phnom Penh is also a city with a largely forgotten literary past, so far as Western writers are concerned. Although for many it was only a way station for travel to the ruins of Angkor, Pierre Loti, the famous French author, and Somerset Maugham visited, as did noted travel writers, at least noted in their own day, such as Horton Broderick and Norman Lewis much later. André Malraux, who eventually became France's Minister of Culture under President de Gaulle, André Malraux briefly spent time in Phnom Penh on his way to steal statuary from a temple at Angkor. And he spent rather longer after he had been apprehended for doing so. Perhaps this latter experience was what coloured his short and disdainful reference to Phnom Penh in his famous novel La Voie Royale, The Royal Way, the book born of his attempt at theft. sadly, the amount of memorable writing about Phnom Penh in the period since independence in 1953 mostly focuses on conflict. This is the case with Christopher Kosh's outstanding novel, Highways to a War, which contains some lyrical descriptions of Phnom Penh, as well as descriptions of conflict. There are local literary and other artistic worlds to be found in Phnom Penh, though access for a foreigner to the former is constrained by a lack of accessible translations. And the book I have written is written without apology by a foreigner for foreigners. It's sadly the case that much of Phnom Penh's tradition has vanished and is never likely to return. This is despite the sterling efforts of Cambodians and foreigners alike to save as much of the cultural past as possible. Few would argue that there is a substantial body of contemporary visual art of note, though this may be changing and contrasts in this particular area with what is happening in modern Vietnam. Traditional dance and theatre survive with difficulty. Indeed, one of the sad facts of life is that when a Cambodian dance troupe with the classical ballet dancing goes abroad, almost inevitably at least one or more members of the troupe defects and does not return to Cambodia. So tradition of all kinds is under threat, not least because so many of the people who were guardians of tradition died in the terrible years when Pol Pot ruled the city. Charting traditional survival in a sharply changing world in which power and impunity are the prevailing values in contemporary Phnom Penh forms the closing chapter of my book. Before 1958, I barely knew of Phnom Penh's existence and had not the slightest expectation that this city would be a continuing part of my life for nearly 50 years, a cause for happiness and deepest despair. When, in 1958, as a 22-year-old trainee diplomat in Canberra, I learned I was being posted to the Australian mission in Cambodia's capital. It wasn't even an embassy at that stage, it was a legation. My ignorance of Phnom Penh and of the country in which it was located was profound. Not only did I know little more than the city's name, I also knew nothing of Cambodia's archaeological riches, the great temples of Angkor, neither of their existence nor their remarkable history. It sounds shameful today, but it's true. I had difficulty imagining what I would find in Phnom Penh, even though the mission's post report summed up a set of remarkably exotic images. I learnt I would attend the ceremonies of the royal palace, where the king was the father of the man who'd been king before him. When Sihanouk abdicated in 1955, he placed his father on the throne. And I found I should equip myself with a suit tailored from white sharkskin cloth, the prescribed dress for the diplomatic corps at daytime functions. When I later came to wear it with my colleagues in the corps, I could never rid myself of the feeling that we looked rather like a seedy collection of Italian ice cream vendors. For my representational duties, the post report noted, I should be aware that offering a coupe de champagne at the end of the day was a favoured form of entertainment. This was only one testimony to the continuing link with France, the former colonial power, whose language was still widely used by the Cambodian government. This, I was told, was the reason for my being sent to Phnom Penh. With some capacity in the language, I was an appropriate, if very junior, choice for the slot falling vacant the following year. Since, in 1958, Phnom Penh was psychologically about as far distant from Cambodia as it was possible to be, I could not discount the thought that I was chosen for this out-of-the-way posting by the Mandarin, the formidable Sir Arthur Tang, who headed the Foreign Service at that time, and that I was sent as a consequence of my having dropped a catch off his bowling in a social cricket match. Many, many years later, I actually plucked up courage to ask him whether there was any connection between the two events. and ever the Grand Mandarin, he looked at me steadfastly without saying a word for about half a minute, and then finally he said, made a career of it, didn't you? Daily life, the Post report told me, would be both eased and complicated by Phnom Penh's setting. In a city where labour was cheap, there would be domestic help. But many of the everyday necessities of living would not be obtainable, or not at a price that was reasonable. No fresh milk, no butter other than what came in tins, the paucity or complete lack of standard pharmaceutical supplies. Reliable medical assistance was unavailable, so that serious illness would require evacuation to Bangkok, something I ultimately experienced when I contracted amoebic dysentery. And I should anticipate, the Post report said, that the city's one so-called department store, the Magasin Moderne, was distinguished more by what it did not have in stock than by the variety of its merchandise. Then, as time to leave Australia drew closer, an attempted rebellion in February 1959 against the authority of Norodom Sihanouk, then Cambodia's undisputed leader, ended with the chief rebel being shot while attempting to escape. It was clear that there was more to Cambodian politics than the comic opera picture conjured up by references to princes and palaces, royal elephants, and exquisite dancing by the court ballet. Phnom Penh was indeed exotic, but part of that exoticism involved a political world that already had a deeply dark character, and which, within less than 10 years, would begin a descent into terrible bloodshed and ultimately a remorseless tyranny of an order that no one had foreseen or could imagine. First impressions have a powerful memory, and so it is that I remember with startling clarity stepping out of the Royal Air Cambodge DC-3 at Dakota at 9 in the morning on the 6th of April 1959 onto the baking tarmac of Pochindong Airport and into a stifling blanket of heat. I'd spent the previous night in Saigon, today's Ho Chi Minh City, a brief stopover which left me with a vivid impression of a big city that still had strong echoes of France in the Orient, even though Vietnam had gained its independence 5 years previously. Now at Phnom Penh's airport, I stood in a setting surrounded by a rural landscape with few buildings in sight apart from the airport terminal. The paddy fields stretch away from the airport's perimeter, and they were dark, dull grey in colour, for this was the height of the dry season and the fields were empty except for the stubble of crops harvested months before. Tall sugar palms provided some sense of scale in the dust-filled air. And here and there in the distance, I saw pillars of dust rising into the sky from the bone-dry tracks that wound through the countryside. They seemed like some Cambodian version of the biblical pillars of smoke by day as they marked the slow passage of ox carts traversing areas impossible to motor traffic. Pochindong Airport is only 4 kilometres from central Phnom Penh, and in 1959, the first two of these ran through largely open country before entering a city that, like Saigon, still preserved strong memories of its past as part of France's colonial empire. Strung out along the Tonle Sap River, the tributary of the Mekong that runs from the Great Lake until it reaches the river's main stream at Phnom Penh, Cambodia's capital in 1959 seemed at first sight blessed by location and apparent prosperity. As I was later to realise, the landmarks remarked on by 19th century travellers and by literary visitors as diverse as Pierre Loti and Somerset Maugham were still there unchanged. The Phnom, or hill, from which the city takes part of its name, matched the image recorded by the French explorers who had travelled past Phnom Penh up the Mekong in the 1860s. And the Royal Palace, with its multicoloured tiles, with its scattered buildings glistening in the sun, stood beside the river as both the symbolic and actual centre of Phnom Penh. In 1959, the city's architectural and demographic character still reflected the tripartite division that had come into being after the French established their protectorate over Cambodia in 1863. The supposed difference between a protectorate and a colony was no more than a legal fig leaf to cover the fact that from the 1860s until it gained independence in 1953, Cambodia was, in every way that mattered, a French colony. There were still sections of the city that could be identified with the colonial European quarter, a Chinese quarter, and a Cambodian quarter. They were no longer, in 1959, as clearly defined as they had been in colonial times, but the names with which they were known still reflected their essential character. Added to these three main divisions were scattered groupings in which Vietnamese predominated. One was in central Phnom Penh, to the west of the Cambodian quarter. The other two locations, where Vietnamese were numerous, were in the area to the north of the European quarter, and in the peninsula formed by the Mekong and Tonle Sap rivers, reached today by the Japanese Friendship Bridge. This latter area, known by its Cambodian name as Shwe Shan Da, was once mostly occupied by members of Cambodia's Islamic community. Today they number 500,000 in the whole of the country, but they were barely half that number in 1959. By the 1950s, the peninsula's large number of Vietnamese inhabitants also gave a strongly Catholic religious identification. This fact did nothing to save it from being the site of a terrible ethnically motivated massacre in the turbulent first months of Cambodia's civil war in 1970. Today, the main road running north past Shwe Shan Da has become home to a series of large, noisy bars and restaurants, many tawdry in character, and more than a few combining their proclaimed services as massage parlours with undisguised identities as the capital's busiest brothels. With the French element of Phnom Penh's population greatly reduced after Cambodia gained independence in 1953, the 500,000 people who lived in the city in 1959 were divided into three roughly equal groups: Cambodians, Chinese, and Vietnamese. These were groups that essentially lived apart socially, whatever work they did together, and they lived apart in their choice of residence. If not at the bottom of the social pyramid, as a coolie or cycle rickshaw rider, a cyclopus in local currency, Cambodians filled the ranks of the civil servants, were teachers, and only occasionally, notably if they were part Chinese in ancestry, engaged in commerce. It was Cambodians who made up the ranks of the Buddhist monks, still referred to by the French term at this time as bonzes. In their saffron-coloured robes, they were a ubiquitous presence at every state ceremony, and they filled the streets near the palace with colour when they poured out of the Buddhist university in the late morning. To succeed in commerce was the aim of Phnom Penh's vigorous and noisy Chinese population, and some did spectacularly well. Then there were the Vietnamese, many of them, as I've indicated previously, Catholic, and an object of dislike and distrust for most Cambodians, who saw them both as traditional enemies and as the ethnic group the French had imported into the country to act in the lower ranks of the colonial administration. In 1959, and for some years afterwards, the men of the Vietnamese community mostly filled roles as clerks and small-scale merchants, while their women frequently worked as domestics, particularly for Western expatriates. For a Western foreigner, Phnom Penh at the beginning of the 1960s was an attractive place to be. Fueled by the presence of a large, free-spending American community, with its embassy and its aid and military missions, the economy was kind to Cambodia's elite. who reaped enormous profits renting out their real estate holdings at inflated prices. To a surprising degree, some of the elite's prosperity did indeed trickle down to the rest of Phnom Penh's community. There was poverty, of course, some of it dire. It was largely hidden from Westerners by the fact that the poor lived in shanty settlements far from the centre of the city, where, in the centre, in any event, the police moved swiftly to remove the occasional beggar from the streets. And if American money was a key to much of Phnom Penh's prosperity, there were still important French commercial interests in the country, notably in the huge rubber plantations on the red earth lands across the Mekong River beyond the northeastern provincial centre of Kampong Cham. The French had surrendered government control to Cambodians, but they were still a powerful, if discreet, force in relation to the country's external politics. The French embassy was, without doubt, the best informed in Cambodia, and it provided a stereotypically Gallic touch to social life in Phnom Penh in the person of its deputy head of mission. He was a debonair and handsome aristocrat, Pierre Matavé de la Ville de Miremont, who rotated his first and second wives, as he referred to them, through Phnom Penh and kept a gibbon in his house. More seriously, the French had a clearly observable presence in cultural terms, from the Lycée des Cartes, staffed by French teachers, the preferred institution for children of Phnom Penh's elite, which continues to function to the present day, to the École Française d'Extrême-Orient, the French school of the Far East, concerned with Cambodia's past cultural history. There was a pervasive presence of French products, though not yet of the Alain Delon cigarettes, named in honour of the French film star, which one sees today advertised widely. They are a relatively recent addition to the Phnom Penh scene, but bred in the characteristic French style, the baguette, was present everywhere, so much so that it had become as much Cambodian as a French food staple, and remains today. In everyday terms, the French presence was apparent in such quintessentially Gallic establishments as the Bar Jean and the Zigzag Bar, both drinking haunts which seem to have been transplanted together with their customers from Marseille. I had a particular affection for a now-vanished, traditionally run restaurant, La Taverne, with Monsieur Mignon as its patron, in the post office square, characterising Australians as Anglo-Saxons, and so not truly appreciative of the joys of food and wine. He would upbraid me for asking whether the seafood he served had been kept on ice as it journeyed up from the coast during the hottest months of the year. "The taste is what matters," he would insist over and again. "It's not what happens in your stomach afterwards." Much of the ambiance I've just described remained when I returned to Phnom Penh to carry out historical research in 1966, but there were already threatening clouds on the political horizon. Sihanouk had renounced American aid, and Cambodia's economy was in decline. The intensity of the war in Vietnam was increasing, and with it Sihanouk's secret decision to seek an accommodation with the Vietnamese communists, whom he feared would ultimately win. And in the face of these new challenges, he increasingly devoted his time to making feature-length films of execrable aesthetic quality. Then in March 1970, his right-wing associates threw him out of office, and for the next 5 years, Cambodia was wracked by a terrible civil war. At first, Phnom Penh was little affected by the war. When I went back in 1971, the only really observable changes were that some of the ministries had barbed wire and sandbags around them, and there seemed to be a tendency for civil servants to wear khaki clothing. But by 1974, as the Khmer Rouge forces opposing the Lon Nol regime that had overthrown Sihanouk came closer to the city, its outskirts began to be ravaged by rocket and then artillery fire. At the same time, the population of the city swelled in size as refugees poured in from the countryside. Finally, in April 1975, Phnom Penh fell to the Cambodian communists led by Pol Pot on the 17th of April 1975. What happened next is well known in its outlines, but still a puzzle for analysts. We know that Pol Pot emptied Phnom Penh of most of its inhabitants, and we understand some, and some only, of the reasons for this. Fundamentally, Pol Pot wanted to remake Cambodian society totally, and he believed that the urban population stood in the way of this great endeavour. There's some reason to believe that he had studied the famous study of the French Revolution by Prince Kropotkin, the anarchist Russian writer, and taken up the argument put forward in that book by the anarchist prince that the failure of the French Revolution was that it was never complete, and he was going to pass over that error and to make the revolution in Cambodia complete. So for 3 years and nearly 9 months, Phnom Penh was a city with its population reduced to about 50,000 to 60,000 people. That's a guess, we really don't know, but that takes in all of the people living in Phnom Penh, those working within the Pol Pot administration, those who serviced it, and those who worked in the limited number of factories that continued to operate. Whole areas of the city were left to rot. Remarkably, relatively little of the city was deliberately damaged or demolished, the exception being the Catholic churches, including the Catholic cathedral, and with one exception, they were all razed to the ground. For reasons that we don't understand, a small chapel in a convent was not destroyed. And it was during this terrible period that the former suburban high school buildings at Tuol Sleng were transformed into an extermination centre. I have in my book quoted the impressions of Phnom Penh from the first Western visitors to come to the city after the Vietnamese invaded and chased Pol Pot and his associates from the capital in January 1979. Their reports make grim reading, and there was much that was grim about what I saw when I was able to visit the city in September 1981. At that time, the estimates put the population of Phnom Penh at somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000. No one really knew, and the services that existed were basic and much dependent upon the support the Vietnamese offered their Cambodian protege. Of that 300,000 to 400,000 living in the city, a very large percentage, again we can't be absolutely sure how many, were squatters. When I went to look at the building that had been the Australian Embassy when I worked there between 1959 and 61, it was accommodating four large squatter families with a pig tethered in the driveway where once I parked my sports car. Throughout the 1980s, Phnom Penh remained the victim of rivalries linked both to the Cold War and to the intense rivalry between Vietnam as a proxy for the Soviet Union and China. Phnom Penh's population slowly grew in size, but the city remained a casualty of the years of war. It was not until the settlement of the Cambodian problem, as it was called, was reached in 1991, and a period of United Nations administration led to elections being held in 1993, that real and rapid change began to take place in the city. Much of what a visitor sees in Phnom Penh today, and particularly away from the city centre, is the result of a building boom that began a decade ago. And to those changes are now added for the first time, as I mentioned a little while ago, a number of high-rise buildings that will transform Phnom Penh's cityscape. Cambodia's capital has now been transformed in other ways, with growing but very unequal prosperity Phnom Penh now experiences traffic jams, and the air is heavy with the fumes of the multiple two-wheeled vehicles that throng the city. Some subjects have an obvious ending. Phnom Penh is not one of these. That the city itself and many of its people are better off in a material sense than was the case in the 1980s, and indeed the 1990s, is arguably correct. It would scarcely be the judgment of those who have just been evicted by the government from their flimsy shanty towns or are waiting for this to happen. Neither would it be the outlook of those men and women who have fearlessly sought to establish trade unions to protect the workers in the garment industry. And for all who live in Phnom Penh, the promise that was inherent in the election of 1993 that something approaching democracy was in prospect for Cambodia has well and truly failed to materialise. Yet it is not the place of a foreigner, no matter how closely involved in the city and no matter for how long, to deny the hope that is clearly held by many younger Cambodians that something better can be achieved than what currently exists. Given the real dangers associated with speaking out against the present governing regime, there is every reason to admire the courage of those in Phnom Penh, particularly the men and women associated with domestic non-governmental organizations, who bravely call for change and are ready to criticize the current political system. In a phrase that has entered the lexicon of any serious discussion of Cambodia and its history, David Chandler has written of the tragedy of Cambodian history. Only a supremely unperceptive optimist would suggest that tragedy is no longer part of the drama played out each day in Phnom Penh. As Phnom Penh and Cambodia as a whole stand poised on the threshold of sudden wealth flowing to the government from the oil deposits that have been discovered in the Gulf of Thailand, might this mean that hope can finally triumph over tragedy? That there is no certain answer to that question is a sad but realistic comment on life in contemporary Phnom Penh.
Milton Austin, Janet Grundy has made her way through the weather, has arrived and has copies of Phnom Penh, the cultural and literary history, which I'm sure Milton will be happy to sign at the end. So we've got a bit over 20 minutes till 7 o'clock, and so it's now time for questions and discussion. Yeah.
I just wonder if you can explain. So often, when the French Empire departs, Algeria, Vietnam, Lebanon, Cambodia, there's problems. And is there something in the French, the way the French colonise, or the way they leave, that seems to leave this problem, which I don't think the British Empire has done so much. I don't want to be raising our flag, but, you know, I do think there's...
The question about the impact of the French Empire, if you just speak to the back of the room. Mm.
Okay. Well, that's a big question and probably demands a much bigger answer than I have time to give. I think the important thing and the fundamental difference was that unlike the opportunities, limited though they were, for instance, in India for the development of a domestic political system, even if the British retained absolute control over security, the French provided very little opportunity for individuals in Cambodia or in Vietnam to play any sort of significant political role while they were in charge.
In your book, you mentioned you came across Wilfred Burchard in Phnom Penh on a number of occasions. And according to people I knew who knew him at Melbourne University in the late 40s, he was a man of great personal charm. But as you point out in your book, he was also very much an agent of the North Vietnamese Communist Party. How did you find Burchard, and what was the occasion that you met him?
Well, I met Burchard in 1966 when I returned as an overage and underpaid graduate student, and Burchard was part of the local scene that included a number of people of varied backgrounds, from the principal foreign advisor to Sihanouk, a man named Charles Maillet, a man very much of the left, who probably was employed, as I mentioned in the book, both by the French and Chinese secret services, and who had a very murky background working for a gang of gangsters in Saigon before he moved to Phnom Penh. And Bochup was one of a number of people who had a curious quasi-official, unofficial link to Sihanouk. Sihanouk certainly looked to Bochup to brief visiting journalists when Harrison Salisbury from the New York Times came through Phnom Penh in 1966. He was steered to talk to Bochup. Bochup was hard-working, hard-drinking, in many ways a sort of very typical old-style foreign correspondent. He churned up whatever number of words he was setting to write each day and went to bed having consumed a considerable amount of alcohol. The way in which I saw Bochup playing a role was in a very limited fashion, that he put the best possible spin on everything associated with the Vietnam War to visiting journalists and to Australian students who came to Phnom Penh. One of the great issues in the closing years of Sihanouk's rule was debate over the extent to whether or not and to what degree there were Vietnamese forces actually in Cambodian territory. Now, all of the evidence now makes absolutely clear that there were substantial numbers of Vietnamese forces using Cambodian territory in the eastern sections of Cambodia. Bochup was very good at saying, no, that's absolute nonsense. I know because I'm in touch with the North Vietnamese.
When you say the best spin on the Vietnam War, you mean from a Hanoi perspective? Yeah. Alan Ginjal.
Milton, in this new thrusting Phnom Penh, did you have a sense at the popular level of how far the Khmer Rouge period is remembered and how far it's blocked out? How are modern Phnom Penhers handling it?
It's a good question, Alan, and a difficult one to answer with precision. And it's difficult to provide a really good answer because 70% of the Cambodian population is under 30 years of age and 50% is under 18 years of age. So by far the largest proportion of the Cambodian population knows virtually nothing by personal experience of the Khmer Rouge period. There are efforts being made by a very admirable non-governmental organisation called the Documentation Centre of Cambodia to try and bring the facts of what happened to the knowledge, to the understanding of the Cambodian population. But that effort has been obstructed by the Cambodian government itself, summed up by Hun Sen in his statement that we should dig a hole and bury history in it. Now, there are very good reasons why Hun Sen wants to do that, because Hun Sen was a military commander under the Khmer Rouge. Now, as I say in the book, nobody has been able to link his name with a particular atrocity. On the other hand, he did not defect from the Khmer Rouge to Vietnam until late in 1977. So that meant he was around for 2.5 years, and the question then becomes, how much did he know of what was going on? And many of his associates did not defect until even later. And he has thought, I don't know with what degree of calculation, that it would be better for people not to dwell on the past. And for that reason, Phnom Penh and Cambodia's history is not taught beyond 1970, either in schools or the universities. And that has just begun to change very much at the edges. A Cambodian scholar, assisted by David Chandler, and working with the Documentation Centre of Cambodia, have produced a book that does give a history of the Khmer Rouge period, designed for use in schools, but it's still not being given official approval to be used. I think the statement from the government is that it may be used by teachers to gain some understanding rather than used as a textbook in the schools.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, yeah.
Just given the urbanisation of a lot of Asia, for example China and the move from provincial areas in, I'm always amazed is the path of the future? Are you going to start that structure and just rip in the provincial areas, or with the age of the population of buildings, the statue you mentioned, number 13 and 20, what's going to happen to the demographics of the country?
Question about the centralisation of the small number of population of Phnom Penh against the rest of the country, yeah?
Mm. Well, nobody really knows if 1.5 million is right or 2 million is the number for the people living in Phnom Penh today. It's somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million, it appears. It's also clear that provincial centres are growing in size, but a fair estimation would be that 80% of the Cambodian population remains peasant farmers or fishermen or fisher persons. The likely change from that, it's hard to see where the jobs would be in the city to accommodate people if they continue to come in, and that's one of the great social problems that's looming in Cambodia at the moment. It's estimated by the World Bank that somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 new work entrants come out of the market each year, and there simply aren't jobs enough for them. 9,000 people graduate from the 43 tertiary institutions that exist in the country of very varying quality, and the estimation is that only 1 in 8 of those people can actually find a job that takes account of the qualifications that they have. So I think that's going to be a restriction on people coming into the city because there aren't jobs for them to fill. But there is a real problem with unemployment, which has begun to surface in youth gangs in Phnom Penh and in Battambang. It's not something that the average visitor comes across, but people concerned with major social issues are beginning to be very concerned about it.
Christian,
To what extent is Islam an influence in the current or future political and public life in Cambodia?
The question is about Islam in Cambodia, and it's a very interesting question. I mentioned in my prepared address that about 500,000 people are followers of Islam in Cambodia today. That's a disputed figure, but I think that's probably about right. They are mostly members of an ethnic group called the Cham, who originally came from central Vietnam, many of them hundreds of years ago. But some are also Malays, and if you see them on the south coast of Cambodia, their dress is identical with the dress you see in the villages in Kelantan and Terengganu in Malaysia. Until the post-Pol Pot period, until 1979, most of these followers of Islam were very nominal adherence to the religion. Very few of them ever made the Hajj. They didn't, for the most part, cover their heads if they were women, except when they went into mosques. Their knowledge of Islam was very restricted and lacking in scholarly detail. Since the overthrow of the Pol Pot regime and with the rise in greater connectivity around the world, including the internet, people in the Middle East have become aware of their Islamic brothers in Cambodia, and people from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other Middle Eastern countries have poured money into Cambodia, and huge new mosques have been built. Some of those who have come to Cambodia as Islamic missionaries preach Wahhabi doctrines, and you now have whole villages that wear Middle Eastern dress, including complete covering by women, which is something you never saw before. To what extent this is a political issue in terms of likely to affect the future, it's very difficult to say. The government seems relatively relaxed about it. I think they feel they've got a very good handle on it in terms of security issues, but it's certainly something that has changed a very great deal.
You mentioned you've just been there. Does that mean that writing a very searching book hasn't affected your freedom of travel there at all?
Not yet. The only time that there's been any development that didn't actually affect my freedom of travel, but I wrote a more dangerous book in many ways when I wrote a biography of Norodom Sihanouk, which was published in 1994. And it went on sale in Phnom Penh. In 1994, there was no bookshop in Phnom Penh. There is now a very good bookshop in Phnom Penh, Monument Books. The only place you could buy books in 1994 was Lucky Market, which was a very basic little soupret, apprentice supermarket. And so copies of this went on sale there. And after it had been on sale for about a week, someone came down from the palace and said, I don't think you should sell that. And so they took it off the shelves, and then a month later they put it back on, and there's never been any problem since. I went to the Russian market at my most recent visit and found that the pirated copies, which have been on sale for many years now, because the book itself is out of print, but you can buy a pirated photocopied edition with a colour cover photocopied, to my chagrin, it's gone down from being $5 a copy last year to now
$3.
Yeah.
Yes,
you've
got to be quick. Yep.
Okay. I read your book on the Mekong, and it provoked us to go up and actually have a look at the graves of the French explorers, who certainly were heroes in anybody's language. But I'm puzzled at the Vietnamese-Cambodian hostility, even accepting that Vietnam has stolen Cambodian territory, which presumably is the reason for the long-standing grievance. But the Vietnamese did, in fact, kick out Pol Pot, didn't they? Recently, there was almost a war over a newspaper headline. Could you sort of explain what's going on in the Vietnamese-Cambodian relationship?
The nature of Cambodian-Vietnamese relationship, the fundamental thing to be aware of is both the fact that you mentioned of the Vietnamese taking over Cambodian land over a period of centuries, but more importantly what happened during the 19th century when the Vietnamese gained control of much of contemporary Cambodia and tried to Vietnamize it. They tried to eliminate Cambodian ways of doing things. They demoted Cambodian members of the royal family to be junior members of the Vietnamese civil service. They treated Cambodians abominably. There's a joke in Cambodia, a rather morbid joke, where you say to someone, don't move your head. And the back story behind that is of the Vietnamese burying three Cambodians in the ground up to their necks, putting a great bowl on top of it, a cauldron, and lighting a fire underneath the cauldron. And the Cambodians were not supposed to move their heads. So, you know, it's a rather unhappy joke, and it's used in a particular way in Cambodia. And the memory of that period in the 1830s and 1840s has burnt a deep feeling of antagonism into Cambodians' view of Vietnam.
And I've got my question is
okay, right down the back. Yeah.
Gave me the impression, which might be wrong, but from 76 to 79, power in Khmer Rouge fell to very young people from 13 years to 16 years. Now, that might have happened in Africa in recent times, but it's rare, even in most extreme conflicts. What do you think was happening within Cambodian society that led to young people being quite powerful with young people. Mm.
Two things that are a response to that question. The first thing is to remember that those who were at the top of the Khmer Rouge were almost all French educated, some of them, as in the case with Khieu Samphan, who had received doctorates from the Sorbonne. So they were all quite educated men at the top. The man who was in charge of the extermination centre at Tuol Sleng, Deutsch, was a mathematics graduate. I mean, these were people who, at least in terms of their accomplishment, were quite well educated. Below them, they had managed to pull in to accept their views and their propaganda and their ideas people from the very lowest, most disadvantaged areas of Cambodia. There were people who were brought in from the right out the extreme areas, the periphery of the Cambodian state, who were led to believe, not without some reason, that they were being treated badly and the people in Phnom Penh were corrupt. Sihanouk's films that I mentioned very briefly were shown to these people from very disadvantaged backgrounds to emphasize the corrupt nature of Phnom Penh society. And when they marched into Phnom Penh on the 17th of April, it's very clear from the way they behaved that they knew very little about modern society. They were therefore extremely malleable when told that they were in charge of these people. They were very young and they were malleable, and they took the authority that was given to them and exercised it often without any restraint whatsoever.
There's got a question right down the back there. Yeah. Yes.
The oil revenue, I think that comes online in 2010, and given how well the Cambodian government has divided and ruled the NGO community, in that so much money flows into Cambodia, yet seems to have very little influence on health policy, what can external bodies like the World Bank do in terms of making the government fiscally responsible, making this process at least partially transparent so that some of this oil revenue actually does trickle down to the rest of the economy rather than just going into the banks of the kleptocracy?
Well, I wish I had an answer to that. The World Bank would certainly like to know, because they don't really know how you can ensure that. In a corrupt society, eliminating corruption is an enormous problem. Just one question, one comment rather. It's not altogether clear. I thought it was going to be 2010 also, but Chevron is keeping very quiet about just when oil is going to come on stream. I mean, your question is entirely appropriate, and I think a lot of thought is being given by international organisations and NGOs to that issue. It will, of course, ultimately depend on the Cambodian government. Now, you can have a government that previously might have been thought of as unwilling to accept guidance, as was the case, for instance, in Laos, that at least in relation to the Nam Tuan Tu Dam has accepted very strict controls as laid down by the World Bank. Whether the Cambodian government will accept similar controls in relation to oil, I think, is very much an open question.
Well, many thanks. Take a seat. We could go on, but of course we don't, because it's 7 o'clock, so I'll be very brief. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Phnom Penh, A Cultural and Literary History, which has got a very nice foreword by William Shawcross, who, of course, addressed our annual dinner about 5 years ago, the British journalist. So I should be very brief and say Milton Osman has had a number of important careers as a diplomat, an academic, now writer, commentator, traveller. But in all of them, I think what his exhibit is a great capacity to communicate in ways that people who don't share his expertise can understand. We've seen that again tonight, and that's also evident in Milton Osman's most recent book. So it's been an important presentation tonight and a great discussion period. It'll be up on our pod tomorrow, published in the Sydney papers in due course when Anne puts the next volume together. But for tonight, well done, and no doubt to be back again soon. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.